Sponsorship of the KQED live audio stream comes from Xfinity Mobile, featuring customized wireless plans. Customers can choose unlimited, buy the gig, shared data, or a mix of both and switch it up anytime. Learn more at xfinitymobile.com.
Welcome to Pacific Time. I'm Juan Ha. Persistence. Thy name is Taiwan. The island's latest bid to join the United Nations was turned down by the world body last week. That makes 15 straight rejections in as many years. The UN cited Beijing's One China policy that says there's only one China and Taiwan is part of it. Taiwan lost its UN seat in 1971 when the international organization switched recognition to Beijing as the sole legitimate government of China. But Taiwan is undaunted, and it plans to launch a fresh bid to join the UN in September. Now the island has an unlikely theme song from an unlikely champion, a Taiwanese heavy metal band. The band Thonic is currently touring the U.S. as part of the Ozfest Rock Festival. That's organized by the heavy metal legend Ozzy Osbourne. And as Caroline Gluck reports, Thonic's music and political message is gaining fans.
But limited by the United Nations. Do you know why? That's because United Nations represents all nations in the world. But you and I and Sonic, we represent underworld. Mexico!
Thonic got an enthusiastic welcome from the crowd as they took to the stage in Mountain View, California. The six-member band, whose name in Greek means Spirits of the Underworld, are playing more than 80 concerts in North America and Europe this summer. They've called their tour Unlimited, a play on words. The first two letters, UN, are capitalized. The band has come to rock, but they're also publicizing the fact that Taiwan is excluded from many international organizations, including the United Nations. Freddie Lim is the band's frontman.
There are more than a million people are going to attend to our shows. So I think instead of just promoting ourselves, our country will need us to do more things. We are very happy to try to promote our country and let the fans know not just about Thonic, but about what we face. Not just our country face these kind of problems, or the citizens face these kind of problems, like we cannot go into the international organizations, like our country is not like other countries.
Do you think some people might be put off by the political message? You shouldn't be kind
of
spreading
messages.
Yeah,
there are lots of people saying that, but we feel we are a rock band. What do you want us to do? Music is music. Don't express anything besides music. And we cannot do that.
Thonic is the first Asian heavy metal band ever to be invited to play at Ozfest. They dress in black and wear elaborate face paint on stage. But they're not just copying Western heavy metal bands. Their visual inspiration is taken from Taiwanese temple gods, and their music draws on local myths and legends, incorporates female vocals, and the Chinese traditional two-stringed violin, the erhu or hena as it's called in Taiwanese. Freddie Lim described their music as melodic, symphonic extreme metal.
It means that we shouting all the time, we groaning all the time. But I think if we look at it in technical way, we have faster drums, faster guitars. And the term symphonic means we have henna. We have strings, keyboards, we have female vocals. And so symphonic means more melodic stuff. Extreme means like more brutal stuff. And we combine two things together.
The style may be brutal, but the musicians conform to Asian notions of polite behavior. Outside their trailer at Ozfest, band members had left their shoes and boots neatly stacked in a row. Some Taiwanese Americans even came to the show with homemade snacks for the homesick band. And non-Taiwanese concert goers in California were impressed by the band's music. and maybe somewhat surprisingly, appeared equally sold on their message.
My first time seeing them, I actually cried on a couple songs. It was that powerful.
I think it's important that if they want it, it's important that Taiwan gets in the UN so they can get their own message across, you know?
I consider them one of the best black metal bands. So I watched like a 5-minute YouTube on their MySpace page, and then it showed like the how they're trying to get into WHO and the UN for the last like 20 years. It's been China's been holding them back. So I think it's really important that they're raising this message for Taiwan's independence.
I think their music is really, really awesome. I'm really happy because I'm actually half Asian to see an Asian band on Ozfest, and instrumentally I think they're beautiful, amazing.
Their website talks about how they want to break up from China and all that, and I guess this is just like another way to do it. And personally, music is a good way, I think. Because I mean, all the garbage that China's been doing for the years and years, it's a good way to break up, but I think they're going to be pretty successful, as you can see.
That kind of reaction is music to the ears of the Taiwanese government, which has been partly sponsoring the band's tour. Information Minister Xie Jiewei admits it's an unusual tactic for any government to use a heavy metal band to help spread its message.
You can say the situation of Taiwan is also quite unusual. We have been isolated for the last 3 or 40 years, and we don't deserve it. And so we have been trying very hard to get through this embargo, this isolation. We have been tried any way, any possibility to get through. And one of the methods which we have been trying to use is culture, is singing songs. And we are not only backing this heavy metal group, we have been backing any groups or persons who tries to tell people outside how we are working hard to make our contribution to the world, how we are working hard to get back to the international community.
Government endorsement for any alternative rock band might be seen as a kiss of death in terms of their credibility. But Thonic's band members say they're happy to cooperate with anyone who shares the same ideals. For Pacific Time, I'm Caroline Gluck in Taipei.
Pacific Time intern Larissa Zhou contributed to this story. And you can see her photographs of Thonic at our website, kqed.org/Pacific Time. The United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is probably kicking himself. He narrowly missed a chance to bang heads with Thonic in concert. Ban was also in the San Francisco Bay Area last week to meet with Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger and highlight climate change issues. And Ban's visit was also personal. In 1962, a Bay Area family took in a young Ban as an exchange student. Michelle Chang has this report.
In 1962, the American Red Cross held an international English language essay contest. They put out a call to their staff members to host the winners. One of those who volunteered was Libba Patterson, who worked in their offices in a San Francisco suburb. She was assigned Ban Ki-moon, a high school senior from South Korea who was making his first trip to America.
He was very mature for 18 and pretty much had his goals already set in life of what he would like to do with his life. It's amazing how much he wanted to learn on this trip. There was nothing frivolous about him as a usual 18 teenager.
The teenager confided to the Patterson family that his ambition was to become a diplomat and represent South Korea abroad. 45 years later, Secretary General Ban was in San Francisco to discuss how the state of California and the UN could cooperate in the fight against global warming. And since he was in the neighborhood, he squeezed in a visit to his old host family's home.
I'm touched to be able to visit this place, my second home, where I dreamt of becoming a diplomat of Korea now. Coming back as Secretary General of the United Nations, I cannot express how much I'm feeling. I'm grateful to the Patterson family. They have shown me all affection, love, kindness during my first visit. They have opened my eyes San Francisco was the gate opening my eyes to the world.
When he came here as a young man, he looked at, when he walked in the house, he said, oh, what a big house. And he says, the last September he was here, he walked in. He says, this is still a big house. And he went up to his bedroom. He wanted to see where he slept. And he says, and we ate. This is where we ate, but not any Asian food. He wanted American food, hamburgers. So we gave him all the American food.
When she opened her house to Ban Ki-moon, Libba Patterson was a relative newcomer to California herself. She had grown up in Arkansas.
When I came to California, it was so different. You know, mostly Arkansas was black and white at that time. And I had never really known the Asian population. And I just think that's what made it so interesting for me. And to find a young man that was so positive. And I think that we bonded. He's just my son, that's all. He thinks of me as being his American mother.
Patterson, who's now 90 years old, has stayed in touch with Ban throughout the years. She's visited Korea and hopes to make a trip to New York soon to see her old friend's new office at the United Nations. For Pacific Time, I'm Michelle Chang in Nevada, California.
In its bid for the 2008 Olympics, China promised it would give foreign media freedom to report stories. At the beginning of the year, officials issued new guidelines that lift travel restrictions from now until 2008. Under the old rules, foreign correspondents had to get permission from local officials when they traveled to do reporting. And despite the relaxed rules, foreign reporters in China say officials haven't lived up to its pledge of open access to stories. Journalists reported being harassed this year, and many have experienced interference in getting stories. That's according to a new survey by the Foreign Correspondents Club of China. Melinda Liu is the group's president and bureau chief for Newsweek magazine in Beijing. She spoke about the challenges of reporting in China.
I think many people would say that the reporting environment here has seen improvements. Again, this survey, which was just completed at the end of July, found that 40% of foreign correspondents who answered the survey thought that there had been improvements. So in other words, things are getting better, but things are still not where they should be. I think that's the best way to analyze this.
Now, it was Wang Wei, the Secretary General of the Beijing Organizing Committee, who promised foreign reporters, quote, complete freedom to report when they come to China, end quote. You can actually exploit the vagueness of that statement. Maybe it only applies to stories about the Olympics, not stories about peasant unrest in Tibet. Are Chinese officials hedging that promise at all?
Well, absolutely. It was such a sweeping comment and so grand that the devil is into the details, obviously. And new regulations that were implemented on January 1st of this year were a remarkable relaxation of the old regulations for foreign media reporting. However, the catch is exactly the catch that you pointed out, which is it's specifically related to Olympics reporting. And there have already been many cases of authorities at the grassroots who have confronted reporters who are talking to peasants or talking to activists or talking to even business people, workers in a factory, and have said, this is not related to the Olympics, so you don't have freedom to report here.
You had mentioned that nearly 70% of reporters in the survey say China is not living up to its pledge of allowing reporting freedom. Yet, you know, I was really surprised that the majority of reporters actually said that they haven't experienced any type of reporting interference by the state this year. So if the state isn't intervening, what else or who else is stopping them from getting stories?
Well, there are some cases, I would say probably a small minority, where we don't even know who was responsible for the interference. For example, there have been cases of correspondents sort of roughed up physically. You know, in other words, violent incidents, quite scary, but by plainclothes people who may have been plainclothes policemen or may have been hired thugs from somewhere, you know, civilians or non-official employees. Mm. So that's a gray area that I think is very much of concern. The other fact is simply that, yes, I think 60% of foreign correspondents here have not reported interference. However, the 40% who have reported interference, when you break it down, there are some who have suffered more than five incidents of interference, and there are some who've been physically roughed up. There are those who have been intimidated, harassed, followed, barred from public spaces, or called in for a reprimand from government officials. Not worthy of what you would expect, what the world would expect from Olympic host. I mean, of course, many developing countries have problems of press freedoms, but not that many developing countries are in China's position of being talked about as the next great superpower, of being, you know, economically on a roll for decades. So when you see that the bar is the standards that the world expects of an Olympic host nation, I think that changes the picture a little bit.
Do you see any evidence that this shift toward more openness might continue after the Olympics?
I do see indications from certain officials, but again, this is a big decision that involves many parts of the Chinese bureaucracy in terms of making a long-term policy decision, and some parts of that bureaucracy are not normally accessible to foreign correspondents. I'm talking about the state security apparatus, for example, which is the counterintelligence people, or the public security apparatus, which does give, you know, they do give interviews and they do hold press conferences, but they don't normally talk very openly about their strategy for trying to control foreign media. So I would say that the central government officials that talk readily about this, that I've spoken to, are quite encouraging. For example, Tu Mingde, who is a senior official with BOCOG, the organizing committee for the Games, the way he put it was, once the door is opened, it's not going to be closed again. And I've heard other similar statements in just casual conversations with Chinese authorities. So there have been some very encouraging hints, I would say, but there's been no final decision. And, of course, the problem will be the closer we get to when these current regulations expire, the more concerned foreign correspondents will be about what happens after the games are over.
Melinda Liu is the president of the Foreign Correspondents Club of China. Last week, we heard about the problems of deforestation in Indonesia. Palm oil plantations are replacing rainforests on the island of Borneo. The palm oil is mixed with diesel to get a cleaner fuel alternative. And the Indonesian government plans to double the number of plantations in the next 6 years to meet booming worldwide demand for the biofuel. The government says the program will lift poor communities out of poverty and create millions of jobs. But as Rebecca Henschke reports, the nomadic farmers who have lived in the forests for thousands of years are losing their way of life.
Hello, Bob.
Hello.
Rebecca.
A farmer named Waadi wipes his forehead and apologizes to his visitors. He's just come out of the fields, he says. That's why he's sweaty. To get here, we've driven through miles and miles of straight rows of palm oil trees, part of the mega plantations that have taken over so much of Borneo. Waadi's little farm is very different. There's not much under cultivation. He mostly harvests forest fruits and rubber and hunts animals in the surrounding jungle. And he's a very lonely farmer, the only person for miles that refused to sell his lands to the Culling Group, a Malaysian palm oil corporation.
There are offers of money, but you have to think, what is that money worth? 100 or 200 million rupiah? It has no meaning to me. I'm hopeless with money. But if I have my land, then I can pass it on to my children and my life is fulfilled.
Twenty miles away, the village of Danau Sempulu has become an island in a sea of palm oil plantations. This village was once famous for making wooden ships. Now there's no wood. All the trees are gone. 60-year-old Edwardi says his community's way of life is being lost forever.
When I met with the plantation company, I told them, you have to understand that this forest is our office. You want to destroy our office? Where will we go? How will we survive?
Most of his forest land has been cleared despite his protests. He, like most people here, didn't have deeds or legal certificates for the land. Indonesian law recognises rights to ancestral or traditional land, but in practice, those rights are often ignored. On the wooden floor of a traditional longhouse, another villager named Eddie strokes the scars on his leg. He was shot by the police in May 2005 while he was protesting against an Indonesian company building a palm oil plantation.
Kami marah karena hak kami dirampas oleh mereka dari perusahaan.
We were fighting against the stealing of our land. Then the police came and defended the company and shot at us. One person was killed. Two were seriously injured. I was shot through the leg.
The company has close family ties to Indonesia's largest political parties, and Eddie's campaign for an investigation has gone nowhere. His family land is gone.
Ya, saya masih tetap tinggal di runtuh, tapi sudah tidak memiliki apa-apa.
Now I own nothing. I have four children, and I'm trying to survive and feed them by fishing. But it's very hard to find fish now. The river is being polluted by the chemical runoff from the plantation.
Indonesian government officials say that the rapidly expanding palm oil industry is bringing much-needed investment to this region, creating jobs, building schools, and upgrading infrastructure. At a palm oil plantation owned by a giant Indonesian cigarette company, plantation manager Sitabu says they're working in partnership with the community.
Kita mengembangkan yang namanya kerjasama dengan masyarakat.
A small part of our plantation is run by local farmers, where they sell the palm to us for processing into oil, and we split the profit 50-50. Many of the local people work on our staff. We also use local transport and provide enormous employment opportunities for this community.
He goes on to explain that the nearby villages now have roads and the people are buying their first televisions and motorbikes. But Betty Tinominar, a campaigner from the local ecological justice group Down to Earth, argues that even with this partnership model, the local farmers lose out.
Farmers have no choice but to sell their product to the factory. So the company is the one who controls the price. The palm oil industry is completely controlled by big companies. There are no independent small farmers. They're all just working for the companies.
On my way home from visiting a new Macking Group plantation site, I meet a local nomadic farmer who is walking into the thick forest that will soon be destroyed. He didn't want the authorities to find out his name, but he made it clear he doesn't want his land turned into a palm oil monoculture. We want to farm rubber, he says. That's something we know. As we drove through the villages, my local guide told me that when he first came here 2 years ago, the local kids didn't know to get out of the way when a car came down the road. They'd never seen one before. That kind of isolation is probably gone forever, no matter what happens to the people who once made their livelihoods in these forests. For Pacific Time, this is Rebecca Hinschke in Central Kalimantan.
And here's some other news from Asia and Asian America. The House of Representatives passed a resolution this week urging Japan to apologize for forcing women and girls into brothels run by the Japanese military during World War II. As we reported last week, the resolution had widespread support from diverse groups of Asian Americans. Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe says the resolution was regrettable, and he indicated the government won't offer an official apology. And Prime Minister Abe is also facing troubles at home. His Liberal Democratic Party was crushed in elections this week and lost its control of the upper house of parliament. Voter confidence has dropped over lost pension records that affected millions of payments. Still, Abe says he's not stepping down. And Cambodia Town hits Main Street. The city of Long Beach in Los Angeles County recently inaugurated the nation's first Cambodia Town. Signs with the new town name will go up in a strip of a street that's now home to Cambodian-run restaurants, jewelry stores, and fabric shops. Supporters lobbied 6 years to get the designation, and initially there was opposition from community members. Long Beach is home to the largest population of Cambodians outside of Cambodia. It's time for us to say goodbye. Our theme music was composed by Anthony Brown with the Asian American Orchestra. Visit us on the web at kqed.org/pacific time. Got a story idea or a comment on something you've heard here? Email us, pacifictime@kqed.org. Our staff includes Nina Thorson, Nguyen Quy Đức, Seal Muller, Susie Racho, Michelle Cheng, Helen Lee, Larissa Zhou, and Raul Ramirez. I'm Juan Ha. Thanks for tuning in.
Funds for the production of Pacific Time are provided by the Freeman Foundation, Matthews International Capital Management, a San Francisco-based advisor investing in the future of Asia since 1994, the Wallace Alexander Gerbode Foundation, and the KQED Campaign for the Future Program Venture Fund.
PRI, Public Radio International.